This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Lee Gutkind, who's the editor of an anthology, a really interesting anthology called True Crime, Real Life Stories of Abduction, Addiction, Obsession, Murder, Grave Robbing, and More. And it also includes an interview with an author named Eric Larson. How are you, Lee?
I'm well. How are you doing today?
I'm well. This is a really interesting book, although, I have to say, for some people, will be difficult. I mean, I'm sure you know that the subjects of these pieces are sometimes very painful. And I'm just really curious what spurred you to put this anthology together.
Well, it comes initially from an issue of the magazine I edit called Creative Nonfiction. We did a true crime issue, and we got many. We publish almost exclusively original material, true stories, well told, and we got many, many submissions, and they were fascinating. So much so that we felt that just doing an issue with six or seven stories wasn't enough. The stories were more powerful and more unique and more varied. So we wanted to, again, put them back together, add some more true crime stories, and make them available to a wider audience. And as you well know, when you do a magazine, once the new magazine comes out, the other one's kind of lost. So if you have a book, the book kind of remains there as something that readers and writers can enjoy for a long period of time.
Well, tell me a little bit about Creative Nonfiction Magazine, because that seems like it's a really interesting area, pretty diverse and covers a lot of territory. How often does Creative Nonfiction come out annually?
It comes out four times a year. And we were the first magazine. We started out as a literary journal, and now we're kind of magazine format, but we're still quite literary. And we were the first to publish narrative nonfiction, first literary journal to publish narrative nonfiction exclusively. And true stories, whether they be narrative journalism or memoir, anything that is completely true that is turned into a hard-hitting, suspenseful, interesting, informative story, whether it's about science or true crime, we're interested in.
And does most of you, the writing that you publish in the magazine, and I guess this would be the question for the book as well, is it born as journalism and then redone, or actually simply reprinted from either a newspaper or another kind of journalistic kind of magazine or venue?
Well, in most cases of what we publish in our anthologies or in the magazine, it's almost exclusively unpublished material that's been submitted to us. We dig deep into our slush pile, and our slush pile is really large and filled with great voices. In this particular case, true crime, which is different than some of our other focuses in issues, we republished two pieces that were initially published in newspapers. And David, so many people these days, since people are not necessarily reading newspapers like they used to, so many people feel that newspapers only cover stories in a shallow way. But we found two very deep, very interesting stories, one from the Tampa Bay Times and one from the Arizona Republic, that dug deep into the roots of crime, one going back to the 1930s in a lynching in Alabama, and one about the shooting of Gabby Giffords in Arizona. And so we captured those stories and reprinted them together. They were printed in newspapers as serials, but we put them all together so that readers could see what newspapers around the country, the kind of work long-form journalists can do.
And those, by the way, those two pieces, I think, were very compelling. Not to say others weren't, but I thought the... I thought the Giffords piece was really, really spectacular. And as well, the lynching piece about Florida, I think it was.
Florida, correct.
In the 30s. I thought that both of them were really compelling and stood out. You know, maybe it is that journalists, I don't know, maybe this is really a question. Do you find that journalists have if they're really good, have a natural ability because of their well, maybe not natural, but because of their training, become good at writing the kinds of creative nonfiction that you're interested in?
Well, that's a really interesting question and something I've thought about for a long time, because when I started Creative Nonfiction Magazine or Journal, I thought that it was going to be a space for journalists to have the opportunity to write not in inches, but in many words, and to extend their craft and their good eye for stories and for details in great depth. But oddly enough, most of the pieces we began receiving over the transom were from fiction writers and poets who wanted to cross genres and write nonfiction. And this was an opportunity for them to use their skills as fiction writers and poets to write true stories. And so more than half of the work that we publish in these anthologies and in our magazine comes from those folks whose secondary interest, at least initially, was in nonfiction. Lately, however, things have changed a bit, and journalists' jobs have receded, those who seem to have ended up have this great skill of being poetic and feeling the pulse beat of terrific, mysterious narratives. And so more and more long-form pieces are ending up written by journalists.
Well, that seems, kind of fits in with the change in the way, I think the web has helped encourage that, you know, maybe it's other factors as well, but it seems that there is now more opportunity for journalists to explore longer form, not in their newspapers, obviously, but in other places, and it seems like that has encouraged journalists to go deeper and farther. You know, maybe that started with magazines in the 60s like Rolling Stone, which kind of created a place for longer narrative nonfiction pieces to live, or maybe the New Yorker as well. You know, certain magazines have definitely encouraged that kind of writing, and now we have online things like Amazon Singles, Byliner, The Atavist, even TED, you know, doing their short books, seem to be encouraging the kind of journalists you're talking about to go longer, go deeper, and kind of use the skills that they have. What you were talking about before made me wonder, and I don't know whether you want to make this judgment, but do you think that of the different categories of writers, can you say that one stands out for you as being more adept at this form, whether it's journalists or fiction writers or poets, or, you know, maybe there's some other category of writer? Does it end up not really mattering? Each one brings their own particular skills and ideas and backgrounds, but none necessarily stands out for you as being better in terms of a category of writer.
I'll respond to that in two ways, because, again, it's something I've given a lot of thought to because of the many pieces that we get. And number one, I was astounded by how many poets began writing creative nonfiction, narrative nonfiction. Our second issue, we're talking 19 years ago, our second issue was called Poets Writing Prose. And we solicited manuscripts literally, primarily from journalists, and we got manuscripts from other folks as well, and they were poets. And I thought, the more I thought about it, the more I thought that poets try harder than fiction writers to make certain their poems are as true, both spiritually and factually, as possible, whereas fiction writers are much more willing and anxious to imagine rather than just recreate. And so Diane Ackerman is a great example of a poet who's turned into a wonderful first-class, prestigious nonfiction writer, and Terry Tempest Williams and W.S. Merwin has done 4 or 5 memoirs. So we could name other poets as well. So that's one thing that I think is interesting, that we will get more factually accurate true stories from poets than we will. And poets also have this ability to observe in great detail people, environments, situations. Again, seems to me, in many cases, more so than fiction writers. The other thing that I think has happened is that, and the web has, I think, absolutely helped this, is that this long-form work also frees journalists to write about themselves. And in the newspapers, many newspapers even now, journalists are not allowed to refer back to themselves, even though they may know more about the stories they're writing than any of the experts that they interview. And creative nonfiction frees the journalist to talk about his or her feelings, observations and situations, and also frees the journalist from having to try to establish the sham of objectivity.
No, I think that's interesting. So what you've answered the question sort of in a roundabout way by not necessarily answering which one is better, but just that any of them can be good, although it sounds like you feel poets maybe have a little bit of an advantage over fiction writers. But of course, it must vary, because I can think of quite a few poets who have failed miserably at writing prose, and I can think of quite a few fiction writers who have been exceptionally good at writing nonfiction.
Oh, totally, absolutely. Philip Roth, for example, who I believe for his nonfiction won a National Book Award.
Right. Well, and of course, many fiction writers are also critics, and you know, they write. Although it is interesting, it's harder to think of right off the top of your head a great novelist who also wrote great nonfiction, you know, not just reviews, not just criticism, but, you know, something like, Silent Spring, for example, you know, that kind of, which is, well, maybe that doesn't fit into creative nonfiction, but anyway, it's just...
I think a couple, though. Our old favorites, Ernest Hemingway and Truman Capote.
Those are good. Right. Well, anybody today, could you point to any particular fiction writers today who are pretty well known, but who have also done exceptional work as in creative nonfiction, not just in journalism?
Well, John Updike just died not too long ago, but he did some wonderful nonfiction pieces for The New Yorker over the years.
Well, that's, yeah, but I'm just wondering if any of their kind of the younger, younger generations of, well, maybe Paul Auster would be one.
Paul would be good. And here's somebody else who's even younger, and has achieved fame and fortune in both fields, fiction and nonfiction, and that's Dave Eggers.
Yep, that's true. And I just saw a Jonathan Lethem nonfiction piece, so maybe he would be in there. Well, anyway, just to go back to your book, because we're sort of going off into other realms, what's the process for you? I mean, how many pieces do you have to read in order to come up with the number of... And also, is this book different from the contents of the magazine issue from which it is drawn? You've got... you know, maybe 15 pieces here. Is this more than you put in the magazine?
Sure, there's a half dozen pieces in the magazine. And there's 4 or 5 of the ones that appeared in the magazine in this book. And and the rest are new pieces for our readers. Most of them, except for the two newspaper pieces that we mentioned, I believe are original pieces that weren't published elsewhere. And interestingly, and I'd like to say that this is true crime, and some of the reviewers have referred to it as literary crime, and which makes it much more subtle and makes it not so not like a Law and Order show that has begins with a murder and ends with a conviction. Usually, it's more real life in the sense that sometimes it ends in ways that the reader will not, in real life ways that the reader will not necessarily be able to gauge by just thinking about the way true crime or the way crime stories go on from a beginning to an end. And also, these are all real people with real-life problems to which we, the readers, can relate. And so lots of things that have happened in the world that have been around us occur in this book. Plus, the writers are quite interesting. We have two police officers who are MFA writers who are writing about their experiences on the job. So that's also quite interesting, and that's another way creative nonfiction is kind of moving forward. It's just not poets and fiction writers. It's people who are scientists and engineers and police officers and nurses.
Right, and all of I think the ones that are first person are really powerful, because I think some of them also disturbing, because you're clearly the writer is transforming the experience into something other than just a recounting of what happened. It becomes, that's where the art in the work is. And I think some they were good, but they still have there's the pain is pretty raw. There's some of these stories in particular they're pretty tough. There's a lot of darkness there.
There's a lot of darkness, and this thing when you write these very vivid true crime stories, the reader connects in such a way that one thinks, and I know I did when I read all these pieces together, this could happen to me. This is not so far out of the realm of possibility that it can't happen, that it can't happen to the normal everyday person. There's one piece here that I like by Vance Boyles, who is a detective, and it's a piece called Regret. And he's faced with the a case that he's working on that he suspects. He absolutely suspects that a man who has been accused of rape actually did not do a rape, and that the woman accuser is lying to him and to her friends and family because of embarrassment. And he's pretty well sure that this is the case, but the man who is accused, his attorney will not allow him to answer many of the questions that Vance is asking him. And because he is not allowed to give the information that the police officer needs to clear him, and of course he doesn't know that the police officer needs this information to clear him, he eventually is tried and convicted and sentenced to a half dozen years in jail.
Right. That piece was, I remember reading that piece and thinking, that was a window onto the thought process of a police officer or detective that I was, I'd never seen before. I thought that was a really interesting piece. And of course, then you get into all other, it allows you to start thinking about, all kinds of issues relating to truth and justice and, how do human beings interact with each other, and judgments he made in that case because of the, the guy lawyering up, it changed everything, changed the whole course of the event for everybody.
Right. And when I read this, I thought, if my attorney, and I trust my attorney, tells me to shut up,
yeah,
and not say anything. I have to, focus. I have to listen to that
right,
man.
Right. And you would do that, and you would, in this particular case, it was the worst advice possible.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And I've thought about, it actually made me think of an experience I had where I took some advice that I thought was absolutely right and turned out to be absolutely wrong and had devastating results for me because I took bad advice. And that then you think, well, how do you know? How do you know what's good advice and what isn't good advice? It's really interesting. There was another question I was going to ask you about this. Also in the preface to the book, you mentioned that you had a personal experience with, this is kind of unusual. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you did, you just said a minute ago, it makes you think that these things could happen to you. But on the other hand, it's, there's a certain level of, I guess just statistics, there are so many millions of us. How many of us will ever experience something as awful as, some of these things that happen to people in this book? But there you had an experience when you were a kid of knowing a couple of people who committed murder, which to me that seems unusual. I'm not sure how many people can say they know a murderer.
I not only knew the murderers, I knew the people who were murdered. And not well, but yeah, these were guys that I went to high school with. And I went to a nice middle class neighborhood high school, and we were all nice kids. And we got into a little bit of trouble, but not a lot of trouble. But there was this old couple who had a mom and pop grocery store in our neighborhood, and the rumor was that, I mean, they looked really poor, and even the store was filled with dust, and they hardly ever had any new products in there to sell except for Coca-Cola and cigarettes. But the rumor, who knows how, the rumor was that these people really had a fortune stored in their back room, and they lived that way just to hide their wealth. That was the rumor, and we joked about it for years and years, and probably the people before us who went to high school joked about it. But these two guys I went to high school with, who I knew quite well, decided to rob this couple, and they got flustered during the robbery because this old couple had no money whatsoever, and they shot them and killed them out of nothing else but panic. And it was quite a scandal in our neighborhood at the time. Why would they even rob them, let alone kill them? What could motivate them to pull that trigger when they knew that they were, instead of getting $20,000, only getting $20? And you think, I sat next to that kid in one of my classes. It could have been me. I could have done something that crazy, and I would not have known what the pressure was, what happened, what was said that made me squeeze that trigger.
Yeah, no, I think that's sort of the power of this the idea of true crime. It takes you out of the somewhat out of the vicariousness of the television and even the fictional versions, and makes you face the realities of what human beings are like, the breadth of human experience, and not always in a good way, although there are redemptive elements to a lot of these stories too. So you get to see, you do get to see, you get to feel some of the we like feeling redeemed, and we like feeling that people around us are better than not. But it does make you right in your face with some of the terrible things that people do.
Absolutely. And the other thing, there's another story, Leviathan in this collection that also demonstrates how one crime can decimate an entire community. And in this case, someone was shot and killed, and all of his family, the neighbors and the families around that family that was eventually killed kind of fell apart. All the people who went to, who were close friends of this boy who was killed, just kind of turned their kind of regular ways of living and changed considerably, quitting the football team, quitting the swimming team, becoming outcasts in their own neighborhood and leaving town just because of the reverberations of the crime they had absolutely positively nothing to do with except for their personal connection with the victim.
Right. Well, that, and I think we have seen this in recent times with the, you know, I live near Newtown, Connecticut, and it's,
oh my God,
you
yes.
know, it's the effects of, the ripple effects of these acts of violence are immense and long lasting. And, you know, it's really, I mean, individually, it's very difficult to be around when these things happen. I think it's, you know, although, and it makes you wonder how did people deal with this in previous times when there was less, you know, we had less resources for emotional discourse. You know, I always think about the, like, what they call the Wild West, you know, that period where, you know, death was everywhere for a lot of people on, you know, both Native Americans, settlers, you know, people coming through. And you just, it's hard to imagine what their world was like with death and mayhem at every turn, you know, danger and fear. And then, the, as you say, the effects of violence, what, you know, what is that, how does that reverberate through generations then? It's really interesting to consider, and of course we don't know what people's experiences were like, because even though people wrote about them, I don't think that there was that much emphasis placed on this kind of the notion of an interior life.
Right. Yes. And of course, I mean, you mentioned those magic words for writers: death, fear, mystery. That's kind of what makes good writing both challenging and satisfying for the writer, and in fact gives it the edge that the readers need to plow through and find out what happens to the people they get involved with as they read the story.
Right, and that of course is the writer's work. The writer's job is to transform that raw experience into something meaningful and sometimes beautiful. Well, listen, Lee, it's been great talking to you about both this book and your work in creative nonfiction. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. I really like the book, True Crime, Real Life Stories of Abduction, Addiction, Obsession, Murder, Grave Robbing, and More. I hope people will find the book and read it.
Thank you. Thanks for having this conversation. It was fun.
My pleasure. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk.